Hey folks, welcome to this week's podcast. Interesting one this week because two guests. The first one is brand new. It is a guy named Lance Osborne who runs a YouTube channel called Fab for Archivist, and he does a lot of research and makes these 10-15 minute videos about one topic relating to the Beatles, and he does lots of research and uses lots of little clips and video and audio. Very interesting stuff. Lots of people watch these things, and the clip that we're talking about today, almost 500,000 people have watched it. It's all about how Bernard Purdy, the amazing drummer, claims to have played on 21 Beatles tracks, and it's just always something that has fascinated me that Bernard Purdy would make such claims when it just isn't true. So that's the first thing you're going to hear. It's about 15 minutes long, me and Lance Osborne. And then when that's over, you're going to get to hear me and Bernard Purdy. Now, this is from January of 2010. It was a live telephone interview, January 23rd, 2010. And it's just me and Bernard talking about his entire career. He has played on such amazing records. And I want to let you know that if you go to the archives and listen to the whole 2-hour show, it's just 2 hours of music that he plays on and our conversation, nothing else. So if you want to hear that much Bernard Purdy music, head over to wfmu.org/Michael. So yeah, after Lance, you're going to get to hear me and Bernard from 2010. And do I bring up the Beatles? Yes, at the end-ish, I ask him about this controversy. And he gives a sort of confusing answer where he brings up playing on the soundtrack for the movie Sgt. Pepper Lonely Hearts Club Band, but I wasn't even sure why he brought that up. It didn't really illuminate anything. I'm not sure what it all meant, but it, again, very interesting. He's an amazing drummer. You can hear him in the background here. So let's hear from first Lance Osborne, and we talk just about this Bernard Purdy controversy, and then we'll hear from Bernard himself. Enjoy. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon. Talking about Bernard Purdy and the Beatles is something that regular listeners will know that I am always into, partly as a little bit of a poke at Bernard Purdy, one of my favorite drummers. And we had him on the show in 2010, and we asked him about the Beatles, and you can listen to that in the archive. Maybe I'll play it later in the program. But somebody, well, a listener brought to my attention a video on YouTube by a guy called the Fab for Archivist, and I had seen it before, and there's a link to it on the playlist below the list of songs, and it really fascinated me. This guy kind of breaks down why it's really most likely not possible that Bernard Purdy, as he claims, plays on a lot of Beatles recordings. The Fab Four Archivist's real name is Lance Osborne. He joins us on the phone to talk about this whole situation. Good morning. How you doing?
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me. I'm doing great.
This video that I'm talking about has, I think, almost 450,000 views on YouTube. That's a lot of people interested in learning the real deal on this.
It's kind of a weird little story for this video to have gotten that big. I was surprised. I've got some other, you know, deep dives on songs, behind the stories, that kind of thing on my channel. But this story, I really didn't expect to take off. So, kind of a weird little human interest piece thing going on, I think.
Yeah, let me say right off that folks can go to fab4archivist.com, and that links to everything that you've been doing for a while now. So this one called Replacing Ringo, it's an amazing story because over the years, Bernard has said lots of things like there are four drummers on the Beatles music and Ringo's not one of them, or things like Ringo doesn't play on anything. Do you know where this started? I mean, I know you've done a lot of research about this. Do you know when the first time he said something like this is?
Yeah, and I kind of walked through this timeline in the video because when I put the story together, I really wanted to, you know, not overanalyze it. Like, I didn't want to become extremely analytical about it and pick apart every little thing. But it was important to look at the timeline to go, okay, was it always this big bombastic story from day one? And come to find out, it wasn't. I think it was in The New Yorker in 1967. That was the first time that he actually talked about working with the Beatles. And even in that, it was almost like in passing when he was being interviewed talking about other artists that he had worked with. He just happened to say the Beatles. And that was the first time that he actually linked it together, but he didn't mention anything about Ringo, anything about Ringo not being on the records, that kind of thing at that time.
And then over the years, some folks started looking into that, and then he kept sort of adding to the story, changing the story. Is that how it goes?
Yeah, from my research, the next kind of dot on the timeline was 11 years later, 1978. He really detailed it. He really went into it. And then this is where it gets kind of weird. So roll with it. He said in the summer of 63, Brian Epstein, the Beatles manager, brought him in to sweeten some tracks that the Beatles had recorded. And he said in that interview, I mean, it's plain as day. It was in Gig Magazine. He said that he overdubbed on top of what Ringo was playing. He said he did it for 21 tracks. He didn't name any of them, except he called one Yeah, 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 which, and I say this in the video, you know, what Beatles song goes, Yeah, 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 She Loves You, right? So you're thinking, man, all this time, I thought that was Ringo playing on She Loves You. Huh.
Well, there, one of the great things about the modern era of Beatle collecting, and this is sort of one of the bedrocks of what you do in your videos, is you explore a little topic and you use all kinds of audiovisual material to support what you're talking about or to flesh it out, just little clips. So are there clips of the Beatles recording Yeah, Yeah, Yeah where you can hear Ringo or the folks talking to Ringo? Because there's so many amazing, insightful studio outtakes where we can hear the Beatles talking right before they're recording.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff has been flying around for years, way before my time even. You know, it started out on vinyl and tapes and that kind of thing. And then, of course, now everything's digital, and sometimes you can find some of this stuff on YouTube. And there are session outtakes. You won't hear Ringo a lot. And I think that's because of the nature of vocal mic placement and such in the studio. You're going to hear John and Paul and George talking back and forth with George Martin, whether it's the arrangement of the song or it's just them trying to figure out a harmony, whatever it is. You won't hear Ringo a lot, but you will hear them talking to him. So his presence is, it's there. There's no doubt about it. And as for She Loves You, I can't remember if there are session outtakes on She Loves You or not. I think we've got a couple of different takes, but I don't know if there's any studio chatter around that.
Hmm. Folks have looked at the timeline, and specifically once Bernard Purdy said 1963, that almost made it even more impossible that he would have played on songs like She Loves You, just because of the timing and because he claims that the Beatles manager, Brian Epstein, was in the room. And if you sort of look at Brian Epstein's schedule, and you know, it would have to been after She Loves You was recorded in the first place, and you look at Purdy's schedule, it just sort of doesn't match up, right?
Sometimes that stuff syncs up just a little bit. So She Loves You was recorded in the summer of 63. But what Purdy says, so going back to this interview in 1978 in Gig Magazine, he says that he overdubbed on top of what Ringo was playing. So all this other stuff about how, and he says it later, right, that Ringo wasn't on any Beatles record. And, you know, some of the stuff that's just really, you know, from outer space. He says right here in 1978 in this first detailed claim that he overdubbed on top of what Ringo was playing. And he said, quote unquote, to keep it happening.
To keep it happening, yeah. Because he had done tons and tons of sweetening records or adding drums to records later. It's hard to know. He says like 20,000 or something. I don't know. His numbers are kind of ridiculous. And I do want to point out, since you mentioned outer space, that it's almost ridiculous that we're debating that this is possible. You know, that we're actually looking for for facts to say that Bernard Purdy is not the drummer on She Loves You. It's, you know, it's almost absurd, and it's important that listeners know that that's the spirit, I think, that we're talking about here. There's just no way. It's Ringo. He doesn't need to keep it happening. Ringo had it happening very well.
Absolutely. As displayed on, you know, many, many live performances. We've got the video of it. It's officially released. Now, sure, maybe some of that stuff got sweetened after the fact, like the Shea Stadium concert. I know they went in and tweaked some stuff after it was actually filmed. And that happens, right, for official releases. But it wasn't this kind of thing. Like, you can take the raw footage and see that Ringo's playing on I Feel Fine live, just like he did in the studio.
One of the times when the fans got flamed on this story was when Max Weinberg, the Bruce Springsteen E Street Band drummer, wrote a book where he interviewed a bunch of drummers, and Bernard Purdy said that he played on 21 tracks. Again, he confirmed that, and he said he knew the names of all the songs, but he was kind of holding that back for some sort of legal challenge or something like that.
I think he said, I'll disclose it if I need me some money.
Again, and I think because people have such respect for Purdy, people don't just go, "You're out of your mind," you know. But it, you know, it's interesting. Max Weinberg, I guess, you know, the same thing that I did. He wants to the interview to continue, so he doesn't just go, "Shut up," you know.
I think that's important, though. You're mentioning the respect that people have for Purdy. He is an excellent, amazing, influential drummer. And I say this in the video as well. I really try to couch this as a, let's just look at the facts. Like, let's just not throw bombs at one another, that kind of thing, right? Like, let's just look at the facts. Let's analyze what he said. Does it sync up with what the documentation shows, with what the footage shows? No, it doesn't. But there's a nugget to the story. There's a nugget of truth in there. And we'll talk about that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It is important to have that perspective that he was a legendary drummer. He is a legendary drummer. He's 80 years old now. But man, he played on some amazing stuff, which again has influenced so many people. It's just this one little story that's like, huh. That's really kind of out there. He didn't need to mention this Beatles connection ever. Even if he had one, even if, you know, however slight, he never needed to mention that for his reputation, for his legacy.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like Paul McCartney mentioning that he wrote Yesterday by himself. He doesn't need to actually bolster his own resume at all. He was in the Beatles. He's pretty good. Yeah, one of the things that Purdy said is he's had his life threatened too many times. That's one reason he doesn't talk about it. And I was thinking for a while, maybe this was sort of like P.T. Barnum humbug. You know, this was just good-natured baloney, and he was just doing it because he knew it would drive people crazy, and it was just kind of a joke to him. But the more you sort of watch the clips and stuff, it doesn't really seem like that. It seems like he just got confused about something, perhaps, and then his own ego or his own, I don't know what, it just wouldn't let him let go of it. So let's go back to what you just mentioned about. There is a connection of something that he could have been confused about, and what is it?
Well, it's not 21 songs, first of all. It's not anything that Ringo ever played on. So most people know this, especially if you're a Beatles fan. The Beatles kind of existed before they were the Beatles, before they were the biggest band in the world. And they spent a lot of time in Germany. And they had a drummer before Ringo, Pete Best. Again, you know, a lot of classic rock fans will know this story. There was actually a recording session that the Beatles did with Tony Sheridan in 1961. And Pete Best was the drummer at the time. And he was just having an off day. And Burt Camfort, which you've probably heard his name before, was actually producing the session. And it just wasn't going well. And Pete Best actually had his bass drum and his toms taken away. It was just a really sloppy session. So they tried to limit his playing to just snare and a couple of cymbals. And so when the records came out, they sound kind of dry. They sound kind of plain. So the Polydor Records recorded that session with the Beatles and Tony Sheridan. It was listed as Tony Sheridan and the Beat Brothers when it first came out. Long story short, Atco Records, which also has a Purdy connection later on with Aretha Franklin, Atco Records obtained the rights from Polydor for this, and they decided that they wanted to sweeten this sound. Long story short, they brought in Bernard Purdy, is what all of the evidence points to. So it wasn't Ringo Starr. It was the Pete Best recordings. It was the pre-Beatles, as most people would understand it. So that's probably where some of this stuff came to Purdy, especially after the Beatles' massive, massive success becoming, again, the biggest band in the world. I think this is where all this stuff kind of, it started to mesh. It started to meld in Purdy's head that he played with the Beatles, or that he replaced Ringo's drumming. Well, he never replaced anybody's drumming. It was overdubs. And he said that. He said as much in 1978, even though this replacement talk came later. On these Atco recordings, I play a comparison clip that shows the unsweetened recording followed by the sweetened recording with not only extra drums, but extra guitar playing as well.
Yeah, you play the same exact portion of a song and you show the before and after the sweetening. So yes, after the Beatles became famous, these old recordings were much more valuable. And so Atco put them out. When did Atco release them? When would have Purdy's contribution have taken place?
So Atco released those in, I think it was June of 64. So it was after Beatlemania, right? Because all that stuff happened in the early parts of 1964. And so, of course, they were trying to capitalize on the Beatles' success, even though it wasn't a direct, you know, quote unquote Beatles tune. And again, it wasn't I Want to Hold Your Hand. It wasn't She Loves You. It wasn't anything like that. This song was called Take Out Some Insurance on Me, Baby. You know, it's not something that most people have heard of. It's kind of rare. But of course, ACCO wanted to capitalize on this and released it in 64, which again, kind of going back to Purdy's timeline, and there's no studio documentation for a session like this, certainly not 50, 60 years later. But that does kind of align. If he said summer of 63, he was brought in, you know, let's stretch that to something like August or September, then ACCO released these in June of 64. That's plausible.
Yeah. And of course, he claimed that Brian Epstein was there, which really would be impossible. And you lay out some good theories why the Beatles would not have sent Brian Epstein to go take care of this. Folks, it's Lance Osborne, the Fab Four archivist. And you can go and check out all of these videos. Go watch them at fab4archivist.com. It's so interesting to me because, again, he makes these some very specific claims which just aren't possible, but then there is this grain of truth to it. One of the things that has always occurred to me over the years, and I own three or four what I call fake Beatles records that were manufactured to sort of look like a Beatles record with a drawing of four guys, or sometimes it's five guys with Beatle haircuts, or a photograph sort of in the shadows of guys holding, you know, instruments that look like Beatles instruments. And they were made, I guess, to sell at Woolworths so that your grandmother would buy it for you and say, hey, I got you a Beatles record. But it's really a record by bands with names like the Merseysiders or, you know, the Beat Boys or things like that. And sometimes they include covers of the Beatles. And I wonder if Purdy didn't play on one of those and didn't really know any better that it wasn't the actual Beatles.
Yeah, it's possible, right? Because if we start adding this up, if he's thinking 21 tracks, what if... So going back to the documentation from that Handbrake session that I was discussing from 61, the Pete Best session there, it wasn't just the one track that I play in the video. I think it was seven tracks total. So how do we get to 21? And I think something like that, you know, could it have been 14 tracks? Could it have been some kind of weird compilation that was released? And again, there's no studio documentation to link this directly to Purdy or anybody else for that matter.
I was going to say that one of the interesting things is that the overdubbing that's apparent in your video is not that great. You know, it's not like it's particularly swinging or doesn't sound particularly great. It's kind of crappy, as a matter of fact. You know, it's odd. I want to tell folks, once again, the Fab Four archivist, Lance Osborne, folks should watch his whole video called Replacing Ringo, the story behind Bernard Purdy and the Beatles. Almost 500,000 views now. I know you've got 40,000 subscribers to your YouTube channel, and there's a whole ton of videos that could keep folks busy watching stuff about the Beatles. Do you ever get hassled by the man? Anybody ever object to you splicing these little pieces into your video?
Yeah, that gets really touchy, right? Especially on YouTube, and this gets in the weeds on YouTube stuff a little bit, but they've got essentially a music detection tool called Content ID, and I fight against that. Fair use exists for creators like myself, and it's where, you know, if we're talking about this almost from a news perspective or research perspective, educational, we can use that. Now, there are all kinds of, there's the four factors of fair use, so if you're a creator, look into all that stuff. You can't just put up a 3-minute song and say, hey, I'm using this under fair use. It doesn't work like that. But if I use a 7-second clip to illustrate exactly what I'm talking about, technically that's legal. That licensing rights issues don't come into play there. But with YouTube's Content ID system, sometimes I have to post it, and then I go, okay, well, 8 seconds gets caught by YouTube, so it's not going to be able to be shown to anybody, so I've got to edit it down. Then I'll get it to 7 seconds or 6.5 seconds. It's really kind of ridiculous with where we're at. But, you know, I'm just trying to play by the rules, trying to play the game as much as possible because I'm trying to get this information out there.
How interesting. Well, thanks for visiting with us and touching on this crazy topic about Bernard Purdy. Again, I think you and I both feel the same. Amazing musician. But this is just cuckoo.
Yeah, his legacy is not in question. And I don't think this video questions any of his skill, right? Again, he's influenced so many drummers. He plays on records that all of us love. And it's just this one thing that kind of makes you go, hmm.
Yeah. All right, let's hear some fake Beatles. Thanks, Lance.
Thanks so much for having me, Michael. Take care.
You hear somebody screaming in the background there. That is Stop from Bernard Purdy and the new reissue of the fantastic soul drums, the world's most recorded drummer. He joins us right now on the telephone. Bernard, welcome to the program. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm fine. I have to say, pretty good.
Yeah, you're always pretty good. This new re-release sounds great. It's just a pleasure to hear. It just sounds like a lot of fun, really.
Well, it was a lot of fun. We had a great time.
Yeah. Let's go back to the beginning. I want to start at the beginning. You were born in Elkton, Maryland, the 11th of 15 children. Is that right?
That's right.
That's a crowded house right there. Was it music? Was there music in your house?
Well, we always had music, but it was more church and gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I was the first one to branch out because of my teacher who lived down the street in the next block. So, and he was a drummer, and he was also a teacher at the high school.
And so when did you think, maybe I want to try playing an instrument?
Yeah.
Oh, when I was three, I was playing drums.
You were playing drums on pots and pans and stuff? Or
pots and pans. And I got my first toy set when I was six.
And was it apparent that you had some sort of, you know, gift?
Yes. That's what's been told to me all my life, that for me, it was natural. Mm-hmm. I learned, you know, it's like learning by osmosis. I could do anything if you showed it, because I was pretty close to a photographic memory. But it was my teacher who actually took me and had me learn the right way.
Yeah, so you were a guy who could just hear somebody do something and then repeat it back. But I think it was this guy, Mr. Hayward, right?
Right.
And he sort of showed you how to be a musician, really.
Right.
And
exactly.
So, and I heard that this guy forced you to play the trumpet and the flute for a year each. Is that right?
About a year and a half on each, because he wanted me to learn music.
And so you were...
I didn't know that then.
You thought he was just torturing you?
I thought he was.
Yeah. So you were the flute player in your high school band for a little while?
He let me play in it.
That's amazing.
I didn't play much.
And then the whole time you're just dying to get back there behind the drums, right?
All I ever wanted to do was to get behind the drums.
So this was, I guess, you know, you're in high school in, I guess, the mid-50s. And what kind of music were you listening to on the radio? What kind of records were you buying?
Oh, we were buying country music. We were buying blues. And we were buying anything from the islands.
Mm.
But Latin was also in, because we had the radio stations that was coming out of New York, that 100,000-watt stations that was coming down into Maryland.
Huh.
So we listened to everything that you could possibly play.
Yeah. So when did you start playing and actually getting paid for it?
When I was 12.
And did you know right away, did you think this is going to be a career for me, or were you thinking medical school or something else?
No, I knew this was what I wanted to do. And it only reiterated when I got paid the $10. Between $8 and $10 is when I got paid, what I got paid. And that was a whole week's salary for me at that time.
Yeah, that's a fortune. So I'm interested in what happened in the period between high school and between when you moved to New York around 1960, 61. What happened in that period in between there?
Well, I was, all that time of coming, I went to Morgan State, and I had almost 2 years at Morgan State. Then I came to New York. Coming to New York, we came here on a whim, trying to get some work. And I met Mickey Baker, Mickey and Sylvia.
The great guitar player, and
right.
They had some...
And that time, they had a place called Sylvia's Blue Maraca. So they came over, they finally came over to hear me, because everybody was raving about me at this little club called the Comic Club. They came that Thursday, and when they left, they said they wanted me to come to the studio on Sunday from 12 to 4. that they're going to re-record Love is Strange. I said, yeah, but that was already, you know, that's a hit. And they said, yes, but we have to do it, and we're doing it for our own label. I said, really? What is, you know, like, well, what does that mean? You know. But, of course, I find out later it meant that they would actually sell it more and make more money, and their version of what was done was the version that was being played all around the world when they redid it.
So that was your first thing was that version of Love is Strange, and you decided I'll stay in New York City. This is going to work out. I mean,
oh yes, because they paid me $80 for 4 hours work.
Well, that sounds amazing. Yeah,
I was rich. I was rich. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe I made that kind of money. That much money. That's a whole month.
Yeah,
salary.
Mickey Baker, just a legendary guy. He plays on so many great records. What a guitar style, and you know, just musical, and just all over the place. And Sylvia ended up running Sugar Hill Records, ended up having hits herself in the 70s. Just a great first thing for you to fall into there.
Oh, yes. I mean, I couldn't believe it. And they were the cause of me to stay.
Hmm. Well, $80, sounds like the $80 was really the cause for you to stay.
Yeah, but I was rich, yeah. But only for 2 days.
What'd you spend the money on?
On people. Buying right. Drinks. You could buy 3 and 4 drinks for $1.
Yeah.
You know, that's 3 for 1 and 4 for 1.
So
those shot glasses. And,
yeah, those days are over. What were things like in New York City, 1960, 61? I mean, I think record companies were still maybe not taking rock and roll so seriously. You know, it was pre-Beatles time. And what was the scene like? How many nightclubs were there? What was the feeling, music-wise?
Well, feel-wise, it was everything. Every kind of club, it didn't matter what the club was. People came in because of what you were playing, so you had to play what the folks wanted, which meant dance music, hit tunes, things like that. It didn't matter what the song was as long as people could remember what it was or knew something about it. So, country music has always been in. Jazz was not the thing that most people went for. But dance music, which is also what the Count Basie, Duke Ellington and all, they called it jazz. But it was all dance music that you had to dance. That was what made everybody happy, because in the clubs, you had to make music that people can pat their feet.
Yeah. So pretty quickly you fell into, you met King Curtis, you started hooking up with people, get more and more jobs, and I assume it was lots of sessions during the day and nightclub work at night. Is that right?
That's right.
And so tell me, I mean, during your busiest time doing sessions, how many sessions a day or a week were you doing?
Well, I was doing 3 to 4 sessions a day and 15 to 20 sessions a week. But I thought that was just normal.
And how did you, I mean, New York City, not the easiest place to get around. How did you get around with a drum set? I mean, you don't bring a drum set on the subway, right?
No, I put them on the bus.
No, you didn't, really?
I did. I put my, I would sneak, especially when I was on 105th Street at Broadway, I would sneak by a car that was close to the bus stop, have my bass drum and my the snare trap case. I'd leave them there and get the bus to stop, then run and grab that and then hop on the bus with that and my cymbal case and everything else. So I end up with 4 pieces all the time.
That's fine. And what size bass kick drum were you using at that point?
At that point, I was using the 22.
Oh, carrying, that's a big drum to carry around.
Yes, but that was the normal.
Yeah. one of the things that makes you so interesting and helped you become the world's most recorded drummer is that you played on such a variety of records. You know, there's jazz records and soul records and rock records and pop records. And as things changed, you changed with them. And you know, and it's just an amazing, as I was trying to figure it all out, it's just an amazing bunch of records. You could have made your name in any one of those categories. It's kind of interesting that you got to do them all. And I'm going to read a bunch of names here because to make sure the folks listening are familiar with this. Here's just a small sampling. Jazz People, Miles Davis and Grant Green and Herbie Mann and Mongo Santa Maria and David Fathead Newman, Dizzy Gillespie, Louis Armstrong. And then this whole funky bunch like Boogaloo Joe Jones and Mongo Santa Maria and Pucho and the Latin Soul Brothers. I mean, just those records, it's a crazy amount of records. It sounds like a lot of fun cutting those records. Also, I noticed a lot of those records were cut right here in New Jersey.
Yes.
I think those are
Rudy Van Gelder.
Right, up at Rudy Van Gelder's. Tell me about cutting those kind of records. You also played with every Oregon guy: Jimmy McGriff, Charles Erlin, Shirley Scott, Jack McDuff, yeah. Jimmy Smith, Johnny Hammond Smith. Cutting those Oregon records sounds like fun. I mean, they're just all very funky and groovy.
Because they had a setup over there that Rudy had everything meticulous and immaculate, no matter what. Clean, the sound was good, he knew what they wanted, he knew what the producers were after, and I gave it to him, because that's what he asked for.
So most of those records cut in one day all the way through?
Some of them, but at the most, it'd be 2 days.
I guess that's one of the things that makes you the world's most recorded drummer, and that record is never going to be broken because they don't make records in 2 days anymore, you know.
No, they don't. They usually now 2 months to 2 years.
Yeah, 2 days to get the snare drum sound.
Yeah, well, they take so long to try to get a sound, and they have so many microphones.
Yeah.
They don't allow the drummer to tune drums because it doesn't matter what you tune them to. They got individual mics on them, and they're trying to mix all of this together, and they mess up everything.
So when you
the way you play it.
Those sessions at Rudy Van Gelder's, how many mics were on the drums?
3.
Oh, wow. That's it. And it sounds huge. You know, it's just a big, big sound there. Pop rock people that you played with, like Peter, Paul, and Mary, Kate and Anna McGarrigle, Steely Dan, Hall & Oates, Al Kooper, Todd Rundgren, Cat Stevens, The Fugs, Bette Midler, Robert Palmer, Jack Jones even, and even recently Alan Jackson, the country guy. Was it a head switch for you to go in and play, you know, one day with Dizzy Gillespie, the next day with Peter, Paul, and Mary?
No, because all you do, your job, no matter what you're doing, your job is to interpret the music. That's what music is all about. That's what reading is about. You interpret the music. When you interpret the music, you got exactly what people ask for, because the rest of the band are going to do the same thing.
Yeah.
That's why they were called. They were called in because they could interpret the music.
And this sort of goes back to your friend, Mr. Hayward, your teacher. The fact that he made you learn to read music, did that just put you head and shoulders above everybody? Just, you know, a drummer that can read music is sort of a rare thing.
Well, let me put it to you this way. I didn't know everybody didn't read music. I thought everyone read music. I didn't know that drummers didn't read, most of them. The point was, for me, it was a way of life. When you talk to a musician, you talk music. That's what they always wanted until you got into the business. And then when you get into the business, they don't ever want to talk music. They want to talk politics. They want to talk about making money, investing money and stuff. But before you get there, if you don't talk about music, you're not going to understand where they're coming from.
Interesting. Soul people: Esther Phillips, Solomon Burke, Benny King, James Brown, B.B. King, Aretha Franklin, Gil Scott-Heron, Roberta Flack, Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, Wilson Pickett, Howard Tate, King Curtis, B.B. King, Brooke Benton, Peaches and Herb, on and on and on. Let's talk, I mean, some great, great soul records. You know, so much fun. Let's talk about James Brown for a minute. You play on It's a Man's 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 World, a few other James Brown tracks. What was he like in the studio? I mean, he seems like sort of a nutty genius.
Well, people didn't know that he wasn't so much the genius. What he was good at is putting and giving sounds to different people. But it was Mr. Sammy Lowe the arranger, who actually came in with a prearrangement of things that James immediately could change stuff because he liked playing the organ, because he could play the organ. And he would play the rhythms that he wanted for the guitar player, for the bass player, and also the percussionist, which included drums.
Mm.
So he heard all these things. But it was Mr. Lowe, Mr. Sammy Lowe, who actually wrote these arrangements and had everything in there before James came to the studio.
Hmm. Let me take one quick pause here to remind everybody we're talking to Bernard Purdy. It's WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and WFMU.org. Did you ever go in a session and find that people were not prepared, or find that the charts were wrong, or that the bass player couldn't play, or that it was less than perfect?
Too many times.
And what do you do? Do you just make the best of it? Do you try to help out?
Well, years ago, no matter what, I always tried to help out, which got me into trouble. One of the things that used to happen to me, because I had still have a big mouth, is that, but I've learned how to control it now. It's not as bad as it was before. You listen to people, and you listen to what they have to say and do. And if you can add something by explaining that maybe if you tried something a different way, it might help in getting what you want out. But in the beginning, I had no diplomacy at all. I thought I knew it all. I was Mr. Know-it-all, because I was always right. No matter what happened, I was always right.
How did you learn to back out of that? That's tough.
Yeah, it's very tough. And it took a couple of young people that made me feel like nothing or an inch tall when they finished telling me about myself, that I finally had to, whoa, I got to back off here because I'm talking too much.
Hmm.
People thought that I was running the session, and it wasn't that. I was always trying to give the best that I could give to whatever we were doing.
Yeah, hard to get.
I heard those things.
Well, it's also interesting because being a drummer, it's very hard. If there's a rhythm section, you know, maybe you can ignore one of the two rhythm guitar players, but it's impossible to ignore the drums. They've either got to capitulate to what you're doing, or it's going to sound like a train wreck. And I guess that sort of went along with your personality a little bit as well, you know?
Yep, it definitely goes.
So you talked about $80 for that first session. During that real busy late 60s time, what was the session fees, what had they gone up to?
By the late 60s, we were up to $43.50. We're now up to $63, $62 a session.
And that's three songs?
Oh, that could be three songs or four.
Three or four songs. And
yeah.
And did you, it's sort of hard to tell. Were you making a lot of money, or were you...
I thought I was making a lot of money.
Did you put it in the bank? Did you buy cars with it? What did you do with it?
Well, most of the time I spent it.
Yeah.
But I was fortunate enough. I saved some money. I put some money aside, but I was very, very lucky because I had quite a few folks that were in the union that helped me a great deal by getting me to invest a little bit. And eventually I started investing in myself by having my own little production company and making my own little record company.
Hmm.
So I'm fortunate. Okay. I'm very, very fortunate because, yes, I saved a little money, and I have a pretty good pension.
Well, that's good. Did you ever consider moving to Los Angeles? There's so much going on out there, you know.
Well, I was a commuter to Los Angeles for about 6 or 7 years, and it was a great thing for me because I got paid for still living in New York, even though they were seeing me every other week in California.
Hmm.
So they were still paying me as a traveling musician.
Okay, so you did a lot of sessions out there. That's one of the things, is, you know, as I was researching this and trying to find tracks that you play on, the documentation isn't that strong. It's hard to know exactly who played on what, and that must get a little bit frustrating not to get the proper credit.
Well, it's worse than that. Because the thing that happened is that with all of that that took place, I created my own little sound. I could tell myself, the, you know, two bars into any song that was out there, oh, so that was me. Because I had created a sound.
Yeah, it's a trademark almost, sure.
It was a trademark. But it got so, I got so busy fixing other people's records. I was fixing as many records as I was making live. Or playing on the original, being the original drummer. I did thousands of overdubs. Literally thousands of overdubs of fixing other people's records. But that was the job. It was part of the job for me. I didn't know other folks didn't do that. And I was doing it all the time.
That's interesting.
Well, I got taught by Les Paul how to fix records.
And did you keep a notebook or a log that has every session in it? Is there such a document?
Well, it's not every session, but yes, I kept my logbooks. It was my date book.
Let's put that on your website. Everybody wants to see that, Bernard. That's
what has happened is that I have now gotten to the point whereas I have about 2,200 different people that I have worked with. And that's now on my little book, in the book that hopefully I got my fingers crossed that this thing is going to come out this year. But we have now covered that many people. And it's a nice feeling.
Yeah,
it's a nice feeling to know that it's now been documented, and there's so many more that are coming in that because of what I had done in the past, asking people to send something in that I worked on with you, and now I have a few hundred more that I can actually add to it.
Yeah, I'd love to see that. I think everyone would love to see that. One of the great things is during all this time you're so busy working on sessions, you also managed to squeeze out a lot of solo records, records under your own name, like this newly reissued Soul Drums record and the follow-up, which never came out, which was all the bonus tracks on this new CD. And it sounds great.
That record was supposed to have been called Alexander's Ragtime Band. That was the second album that I had worked on, and they never released it.
Yeah, the tracks are here. They sound great. Let me mention some people. You tell me about your memories of them. Galt McDermott is a guy you hooked up with early when you came to New York, and you're still hooked up with him today, right?
Right. We've been together for 45 years.
Yeah. What an amazing, totally unique musician. He's been a guest on this program. And Hair, still popular. Are you still playing on Broadway right now?
Yes, I am. I'm on Broadway playing Hair right now. We're getting ready to have the cast that's playing now is going to London. So we have a new cast that'll start in March. And then we'll have a second cast for September that's going to go on the road.
And is that still, I mean, that must be, you're not a young man. Does it take a little bit of energy to play two shows on Sunday and Wednesday? And, you know,
it takes a lot of energy. A little bit. It takes a lot of energy. But I'm fortunate that Wilbur Bascom, the bass player, really keeps me humping. And on top of everything else, I don't have the problems that most people have. I'm not a sickly person. I don't drink, and I don't smoke, and I don't do all these things that other folks do. So my health is in good shape.
You know, I wanted to say, I don't know how to say this too gingerly, but on the cover of Soul Drums, a very skinny young man playing the drums there. You've put on a couple of pounds since then. Has it changed the way you hit the drums?
Yeah, it's changed the way that I hit the drums because I don't put as much effort as I did then. I was using more arms then. Now I use more wrists. I go back to what I was taught in the beginning.
Hmm.
So I now have the longevity of being able to say, this works for me because I've learned how to control all of my playing so much better than what I did before.
Tell me about going to Galt McDermott's and making those instrumental records. There's some just little instrumentals, him on an organ and maybe a bass player and you, and they're just these beautiful little pieces. I mean, how were those worked up?
Oh, they were worked up. When he came, we do rehearsals. We get paid to come in to rehearse his music and anything that he's composing and writing and arranging. There, I get a chance to change anything that's happening before it's finalized. And the beauty for me is that so much of it is what I've chosen to do or to make changes on, that I'm totally into him because he's writing the way I would write. So it's not like I'm doing something different. I feel though I'm an extension of Galt. And that's the same thing with Wilbur, the bass player, that we are an extension of him because we hear what he wants, we know where he wants to go, so the rhythm comes out immediately. We don't have a problem with anything that he writes because we can rearrange it, even rewrite it, if it comes down to that, if it sounds better the way we want to do it.
Yeah, very sympathetic to him. That's exactly. Tell me about Bob Marley. I read that you play on some Bob Marley tracks. Is that correct?
The first two albums of Bob Marley.
And recorded where?
In Jamaica. In Jamaica at Kingston. There's a recording studio out there.
And what was that? I mean, that's a little bit of a culture shock from New York City, 1960, you know?
Not really. Not me. It was a job.
Everything's a job.
Yeah, I tried to explain to people, whatever the music is, that's what you do. You get into the music.
Yeah.
You don't worry about who's playing what, when, and where. You just do your job. It didn't have anything to do with anything else. What happened with him is he would hear something. Bam. We'd go and we'd play something. Then he'd hear another song. Do that. We might do two or three songs right in a row. And then he'd go outside and sit on the rock and smoke. Now we might sit there for 2 or 3 hours waiting for him to come back in the studio because he's out on the rock smoking. And when he came back in, bam, we might hit 2, 3, 4, 5 records because he hears all these things and he's thinking and then going. And that's how all those records, both of those records were made.
Interesting. Tell me about Gil Scott-Heron. I mean, the Revolution will not be televised. We heard that a few minutes ago. I mean, that's a pretty heavy record.
Well, a lot of folks didn't know that I was actually producing those for Bob Field, for Flying Dutchman. But I didn't know I was producing. I worked for him. I worked for Flying Dutchman Records. And it was my job to keep the sessions and everything going because Gil would go outside or whatever. And I just kept everything going. I always did. That was part of my job. And I didn't know that I was actually producing the record. But Gil, as far as Gil is concerned, Bob Field is the one who got the credit as the producer. But that's the way it was. That was the way most records were done. I hear things, they let me have my head, and we go. The Stair Steps, Ucha. Ucha, we did everything that you can possibly think of someplace else. In the last 20 minutes of the session, Vince gave me my head, bam. 15 minutes later, we have Fool Child, My Way. And that's the way I hear records.
Oh,
I hear things like that. And
I didn't know that was you playing. You're playing the drums on the Five Steps Ucha.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a heck of a job. It's kind of interesting you say that, because I was wondering about the role of producer, especially in, you know, Phil Spector's a record producer. There's no question about it. You know, I guess he's also a murderer, but that's another story. But on jazz records, the role of the producer is a little more of a, you know, who knows what they're doing. And I always wondered about, especially on jazz records, somebody's credited as a producer. I'm not sure what that means, you know.
Because they're the ones who are able to get the money.
Well, that's...
It comes down to...
It's important.
Dollars and cents. It's all about the money.
Yeah. Tell me about Don Covey. I love those early Don Covey records. They're just beautiful, little teeny, you know, gems. I read somewhere that Jimi Hendrix perhaps played on some of those early records that you're on. Is that possible?
Yeah, because I was the one that was contracting. He used to be with me with King Curtis. 2 years he was with me with King Curtis, and King Curtis liked him because the way he played the guitar, because he was teaching King Curtis how to play guitar.
Oh.
But as far as Don Covey, everything we did with Don Covey was a demo. They all became masters, and they became masters because what we did nobody could duplicate, and it was really that simple.
Yeah, I think those records are amazing. So, Billy Preston, did you? I mean, not Billy Preston. Jimi Hendrix. Any idea that he'd become this crazy superstar?
Oh no, none of us. None of us thought of him as anything except a great guitar player.
Yeah. Tell me about working with Nina Simone. You play on all of my favorite Nina Simone records. I mean, they're funky, they're great, they sound good, they're warm. Her singing is fantastic. Were those all recorded 100% live, or is there overdubs on those?
99% of them was live.
And again, she seems like another woman who, a little scary to me, you know? I'm not sure I want to get on her bad side.
Well, see, that, you're 100% right. Nobody wanted to get on her bad side. But the point of what Nina was about, she was a perfectionist. Folks didn't know that. She just, you do your job, and you'd never have any problem with her coming down on you. Because she liked people that know what you're supposed to do, and you go and do it. And that's what we did. I never had a problem with her, ever. Because I would just do the job. If I didn't like something, the reason why I got a chance to do something over again, because it was written all over my face. My face tells everything.
So they would say, maybe Bernard's not so happy with that take, you want to take another one, and you got a little more in you?
Yeah, go ahead.
So, I mean, Nina Simone, you know, she recorded To Love Somebody or Save Me or something like that. Was there a moment, would you take a moment after a take and go, wow, that's good, or was it all business?
Well, for me, if I liked something, I spoke up, period. I always did. I couldn't help myself because I was enthusiastic. I would end up going into the control room. I was liking what I was hearing, and... If I wasn't, and if I didn't, they want to know, well, what's wrong, Freddie? No, come on. It's all over your face. Come on, tell us. Tell us what. And then I do. I just tell them.
Let's talk about the King Curtis Band. I mean, a lot of great people passed in and out of that band. Billy Preston, Cornell Dupree, Willie T, yourself, Gerald Jermott, and King Curtis himself, of course, played on all kinds of records, backed all kinds of people. What kind of a guy was he? I mean, it seems like just a real intuitive musician.
I thought King Curtis was, to me, one of the best musicians that ever lived. The man learned his craft, and he learned it well. He could play it at any given time and moment, and you always felt good when he finished playing that horn. He had a gift. He had a major, major gift of picking out artists for Atlantic Records. That's what he did.
Yeah.
People didn't know that 98% of all the artists that was on Atlantic, King Curtis picked them out during that time.
Is there a certain gift he had in terms of leading a band and putting a band together?
Well, he was always a band leader.
Yeah.
But he was always, him being humble was like, alligator, you know, when he strikes, if he takes another a snake or something out, just snap him in two. Being humble was not in his vocabulary, but the man was a genius of what he did. So he didn't have to talk about how good he was. He just showed you.
Interesting. Let's talk about Aretha Franklin. I think in 1970 you started with her, and you played on some of her biggest, best records, and played with her live for a long time. Another, you know, just she's just loaded with talent, that lady, right?
Miss Franklin was, or I should say is the diva of all divas. And please don't get me wrong, what the thing is that the lady always knew what she wanted. When you know what you want, you go after it. You ask for it. You say, this is what I want. This is how I'm going. Such and such is the case. You just go and do it. It really is that simple, because her voice carried her to wherever she needed to go. She wasn't the best of speaking to people, but when she came down to the singing, nobody in the world could beat it. So, being humble, not in the category.
Another one.
You have to respect somebody who knows what they want and just go after and go do it.
I heard she's a good cook. Did she ever make a meal for you?
Excellent cook.
Yeah.
Excellent cook. But so am I.
Yeah, what's your thing?
Oh, I fix everything. I'm into the meats. I'm into the sauces. I'm into all those kind of things. Like I'm still a meat eater, and I still do very, very well with it. I don't bake many pies or cakes. I don't have the patience when it comes down to that, as I do with everything else. I can prepare any kind of dinner. I can prepare a dinner for 300 to 500 people better than I can for 5 to 10.
500?
Because I did it for so long.
Well, it sounds like fun. I'm coming over.
For me, because I enjoyed doing that. When I gave all of my parties, I did all the cooking. I was even the bartender because I was always sober.
Ah. Oh, so you never drank at all. That's amazing.
Oh, no. I drank when I was a kid.
Hmm.
I was an alcoholic at the age of 11, and I stopped at 13 because I just got tired of being beat by my father. So I just stopped.
Yeah.
Didn't like the taste in the first place, so I just stopped.
Tell me, what music do you listen to today if you're driving to the supermarket, do you listen to music in your downtime?
I listen to every kind of music. Doesn't matter what it is, as long as it's good.
Hmm. And what
stuff that I like hearing the beat. I'm not necessarily interested in as the rappers have. I'm the language thing doesn't do it for me. I'm totally against the language thing because that's just my upbringing. I'm no prune. And so I get out of their way. I let them have their way.
Speaking of rappers, that must be sort of a frustrating thing. I'm sure tracks you play on have been sampled just for the beat, and you don't make a cent out of that.
Yes. I was very upset for a long time. Now they're beginning to pay me because I'm still alive and kicking. And they do want the stuff that I have. And it worked out real, real well for me. So I don't knock the rappers. You know, just keep on rapping if that's what you got to do. And now that you got to pay me, I'm going to enjoy it even more.
tell me about, were there records that came out in the 60s that you heard, can you think of an example and said, boy, that's some good drumming? You know, is there other performances, other records that you particularly like the drumming on?
You mean my drumming?
No, somebody else. Is there?
Oh, somebody else?
Yeah.
Oh, Jeff Bacala. Yeah, he's done some fabulous, fabulous drumming. And it's very nice because it's turned around that he's giving me the credit for what he did, what he learned, the Purdy Shuffle.
Mm.
He just tried to turn it around. So that's where Rosanna came from.
Tell me about disco music. When disco music happened, did you have a stroke or anything? Did you?
Oh, disco music happening. I was making Who Gobbles the Money? Because it all came down to what I was doing on the hi-hat.
Yeah. And then what about the 80s and sort of drum machines came in? Did you have a heart attack at that point?
Nope. I learned how to use them.
you're a guy who gives back. If folks go on YouTube, I mean, there are loads and loads of teaching videos and seminars and things where you, it seems like that's a big part of your life now, doing seminars, teaching folks. I think you still teach every Thursday at the New School in Manhattan, is that right?
Yeah, at the New School, yes.
And
I have my R&B class.
And you just teach, and have you been doing this for years?
Yeah, I started it 25 years ago.
I took
a hiatus because the politics, and they asked me back 5 years ago.
And you're still doing hair?
I'm still doing hair.
On Broadway?
Eight shows a week. Now they finally let me out where I can come and go. And it's kind of nice. So I now have 4 subs. I'm working on 2 more to make sure that these 4 stay, that will stay and hang around. So it's a good thing. And I'm just happy.
Yeah.
On top of everything else, you know, I'm making money.
Can't argue.
So it's a good time. It's a good age for me. And being around the young people keeps me young.
Yeah.
Useful.
I've got to ask you about the controversy over the Beatles tracks. In the Max Weinberg, he has this great book where he interviews a bunch of drummers, and you talk about playing on lots and lots of Beatles tracks. What's the deal with that?
Well, the deal with it is that I don't care whether they know or accept what I have done anymore about the Beatles, because the Beatles was one phase of my life that has hurt me because folks believe that I fabricated this, and you know something? I don't care anymore. It really doesn't matter. I know what I did. I played on 21 tracks. I fixed them, and that's that. I don't care whether they ever believe. I don't even talk about them anymore.
So what?
Because it's not worth it.
What time period are we talking about?
In the beginning, before they even got here. Huh. All their records were made before they even came over here. Their records and stuff, that music was brought over here to be fixed, and that's what it was. Every one of those albums that they did. And what happens later? Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Heart Club Band? Well, I did the movie.
The movie, yeah.
Yeah, I did the movie. Now, all of a sudden, everybody is listening to the things that are happening into the movie, and they can hear all these other, wow. Wow. I said, yeah. Wow. But like I said before, I don't care.
Well, some people
have don't care whether they believe me or not.
Yeah, some people
it's irrelevant anymore to my life.
Some people have suggested that perhaps it's that early stuff they recorded in Germany that ended up getting recorded over. But you're saying it's a little more of the well-known hits. Is that right?
Yeah, it's some of the hits. And yes, the stuff that was done in Germany was also done in England. Folks don't know. They think they know what things are and what people did. What we had to do from the 60s and the 70s, we fixed thousands of records for people because at that time they were not allowing the bands to make their own record. The record companies were paying us to do a job, and that's what we did. We did a job. And now all of a sudden the public thinks that, wow, you mean all these groups are not doing what they said they did? No, because there was too much money involved. They wanted something good, and they wanted it to happen right away, and they weren't going to spend thousands upon thousands of dollars waiting for somebody to learn something in the studio. That's where the studio musician came in, and that's what we did.
Yeah. Let's talk about Soul Drums. It's such a great record, and it's so unusual to hear drums featured on a record. So, you know, it's one of the things as I was listening to this new reissue, you know, how refreshing it is just to have the drums really loud, you know? It just, it's different.
Yes.
And another,
very different.
Another thing I love about this record, too, and I don't know how you feel about this, is that all the songs pretty much are under 3 minutes long. So
that's right, because we had to make songs for singles. Everything we did, we were told to make songs that could come out as singles. And that's what we did.
Yeah, I think that's great because a lot of times jazz or funky jazz records is a 6-minute, 7-minute, you know, long song and everybody gets solos. But on this album, it's, you know, it's real hook packed because it's all packed in 2.5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. That's why I love it.
And I know that, like, people all over the world have, you know, it's been a very collectible album, so I think people are happy to see this new CD out. It's on the Green Street Sony Market, Sony Custom label. I hope they all sell out and somehow some of that money gets back to you.
Not only are they all going to sell out, but they're going to have to reorder a whole lot more.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I'll be doing a promotion on it, even myself. But as soon as they get their act together and they want to sell me some so I can sell it to my audience that I'm out here with, they'll do even better.
Yeah, I'm sure. BernardPurdy.com is your website. There's all kinds of information and stuff on there. Mm-hmm. It has been a real pleasure talking to you. I mean, what an incredible career. I mean, so many records, so little time. You know, we could do a whole week of Bernard Purdy. Maybe we will someday.
Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Yeah. We're going to hear the
very much.
Yeah, we're going to hear the track Soul Drums right now. It's the title track off this record. Is there anything else the folks out there need to know about you or about making this album or anything?
No, it was a super joy of my life because the band, the members that were there with me, only 2 or 3 of them are still with me today. But I had a love of what I was doing, and I'm just happy to see it come back out again.
Yeah. Bernard Purdy, thanks so much, and, you know, check in with us sometime again. I'd love to talk to you again.
You got it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.